Cloudy skies and partly sunny for Wednesday.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Wayne Lesprince, and this is The Exchange. A casualty of war that many times escapes the headlines. Men and women returning from combat with deep scars that are far less noticeable, that don't require wheelchairs or bandages. Mental health issues like PTSD and traumatic brain injury, along with a sharp rise in suicide. But added to that problem is that once home, many aren't receiving the mental health care they need, and those who are trying to find mental health care are finding a backlog in the system. Yesterday, a report released by the Inspector General of the Department of Veterans Affairs stated that the backlog is even longer than originally thought. In fact, the report suggests that it takes upwards of 50 days to even get an appointment for mental health care evaluation. This hour on The Exchange, understanding the less obvious wounds of our military personnel. Let's hear from you. How well are we doing at caring for those who have gone into harm's way? Is the Veterans Administration up to the task of providing services to the growing number of troops identified with mental health issues? Are you a veteran or a family member of a veteran? Have you received any mental health care from a VA facility? What has your experience been? Are we doing enough? Our number is 1-800-892-NHPR or 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us at exchange@nhpr.org. We'll start off today by talking to Megan McCluskey. She's a reporter for the Stars and Stripes newspaper that serves the U.S. military and has been following the latest on this new report. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Happy to be here.
So, Megan, the report says that it's taking far longer for returning vets to get an appointment for mental health care. The VA said it takes 2 weeks, when in actuality, the IG report found that it takes upwards of about 50 days. Why is this the case?
Well, one of the main reasons is that there simply aren't enough mental health care providers, nurses, psychiatrists, psychologists. There's a shortage nationwide, and the VAs have a hard time hiring them. And so even though from 2005 to 2010, they increased their staff by 46%, they still just don't have enough people to deal with the increasing number of veterans who are coming in with mental health needs.
So the shortage, I guess, of the staff psychiatrists, the nurses, as you mentioned, is that a function of there not being enough resources for the VA, or how do we explain that?
You know, there's just not enough people who are going into this profession. So there's actually a shortage outside of the VA as well. There's not enough mental health professionals in the civilian side. And the VA is just having trouble hiring people.
And has this been an issue that's been ongoing for some time, or is this a relatively new phenomenon?
It has been going on for a couple of years. Both the Department of Defense and the VA have been desperately trying to hire new professionals, but they have shortages all over. They just can't fill the vacancies. And so if you're in a area that's rural, it's even harder because it's difficult to attract professionals to come out into these areas and say, you know, middle of nowhere, Texas or North Carolina, where there's lots of veterans.
You know, until this report came out, I wonder how much awareness there was about these shortages and generally these issues. In your reporting, have you found that there is an absence of awareness, or is this something people know about?
You know, it's been interesting. The VA for quite a long time, in congressional hearings, had been saying that 95% of all patients that come through the VA with mental health needs are seen within 2 weeks. But we had just seen overwhelming evidence anecdotally from either providers or patients saying that it could take months. And, you know, in some areas of the country, it's up to 80 days. So folks are waiting almost 3 months to get an appointment. And I think that there was an awareness on, certainly at the service member level and with their families, that they could get in. But for the main point from the VA, weren't a hearing and acknowledgement. This is really the first time that they've been called out with contradictory data, and now there's going to be a very large hearing tomorrow at the Senate that I'm sure will really take them to task.
One of the pieces that wasn't covered in the report was the issue of family members. Are we hearing from family members is that how this got to our attention, that they're complaining that they're not able to get their service member to an appointment, to care?
Yeah, family members have been very vocal on this. They because they also need help, you know, dealing with multiple deployments. You have a lot of wives who have been single mothers for years on end, and they also need to be seen, and they can't get in as well. So they tend to be the best advocates sometimes for their service members and their veterans who won't speak up on their own behalf. And so they have really been vocal about, you know, there being a need that's not being fulfilled.
Wow, so this isn't just an issue for combat veterans. This is an issue for their family members who are also seeking care.
Absolutely, and their children.
And their children. Wow. A couple more just quick questions. One is about the changing culture of the military. There's sort of the stereotype out there of the stoic warrior who doesn't talk about his or her problems, the sort of greatest generation, never talking about their service. Is it a function of these folks are now actively seeking more care than in the past, or is there is it just simply the numbers of folks who are being affected by deployments?
I think it's both. You know, unprecedented 10 years of war with men going on multiple deployments versus World War II, where they might be gone for 2 years at a time, but when they were home, they were done. Now we have guys going back into war zones again and again and again, and so there is an increase in folks who need this care. There's also been a very proactive campaign by the military to end the stigma, to tell people it's okay to talk. And we've seen real success with the Marine Corps. They've had a program that has been very active in having people come forward with their stories, including officers, high-ranking officers, to really show that it's okay to have these issues in the first place and to seek help, that it's not a weakness. And so we have seen that reflected in the amount of people who are asking for help.
Well, Megan, thanks for your insight and your reporting on this issue, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
That's Megan McCluskey, a reporter for Stars and Stripes newspaper that serves the U.S. military. For the rest of the hour, we're joined by a panel of guests. Joining us in studio today, Lauren Haberski, a suicide prevention coordinator from the Manchester VA Medical Center, and Lauren is also a licensed social worker. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning.
From Massachusetts, we're joined by Jonathan Shea, former staff psychiatrist at the Department of Veterans Affairs, Boston Outpatient Clinic, and author of Odysseus in America, Combat Trauma and Trials of Homecoming. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning.
And from New York City, we have Jason Hansman. He's the membership director for the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. He also is an Operation Iraqi Freedom veteran of the United States Army. How are you this morning, Jason?
Good. How are you?
Thank you. Well, gentlemen, let's start with you, Dr. Shea. Your thoughts on the IG report?
Well, it sort of pushed one of my buttons in that I haven't read the whole thing. I just read the executive summary. It just hit my computer today. Is that it emphasizes, I think, to great a degree, the importance of credentialed mental health professionals and doesn't ever mention peers. Just imagine how all of this would change if the moment someone asked for help at the VA, they were sort of gathered into a group of veteran peer support people who would give them the social nourishment and social recognition. And as far as I'm concerned, really, veterans mainly heal each other, and that we credentialed professionals are good as stagehands. We don't belong in center stage. They do.
Well, that's a very important point, the peer-to-peer care that you mentioned, and we're going to come back to that in more detail in just a second. Jason, the IG report, critical about the wait time to get that initial assessment. Your thoughts on that?
Deeply troubling for a couple reasons. I think the first one is that the VA didn't seem to be completely honest about the wait times, but also that, you know, there's a very big difference between the wait times between different VAs. I believe the report said the Milwaukee VA had a 28-day wait, but the Spokane VA, out where I'm from originally, had an 80-day wait. I mean, that difference in standard of care alone should be troubling.
Lauren, your take on the IG report.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was obviously pretty disheartening to see that, you know, in print last night. And I think, you know, Manchester has definitely felt the pressure for some time now with, you know, a lot of the veterans coming back, a lot of the National Guard veterans, and then, you know, just, you know, veterans of you know, previous time frames. So I think, you know, we've tried to take a pretty aggressive stance in making sure veterans can get into care as quickly as possible. So we've done things like we have a walk-in clinic located in our primary care at the VA, so veterans can get into care and, you know, sort of strike while the iron's hot. So they actually, there's, you know, a zero wait time between wanting to get into mental health care and actually being able to do that. And then we've also done things like, you know, if they're assessed to be suicidal or, you know, they're in acute distress, we're able to, you know, fast track them into, you know, into treatment. We're also offering a lot of evidence-based treatments over at RVA, you know, to treat things like depression and PTSD. So, you know, we're sort of doing the best we can right now. But there are certainly, you know, cases where once they get their intake, they may wait, you know, several weeks in between appointments.
Is there a distinction between those who come with physical injuries who, you know, were injured in combat physically as opposed to the mental health in terms of that wait time? Are those folks, is it easier or quicker to get the treatment for those folks?
You know, I can't really speak to, getting physical, sure, physical help or, you know, treatment for physical injuries. You know, we also have, you know, urgent care where folks can come in if they're in acute distress, right, for those things.
All right. Well, let's step back a second. And so, you know, the IG report suggests that there's a shortage of nurses, shortage of psychiatrists, that these are highly skilled positions, and there simply aren't the folks out there to hire for these things. I want to just take very quickly your take on this, Lauren. Is that your understanding as well? There's a shortage of those folks?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I know that we've had a psychiatry position open at the Manchester VA for quite some time now. I would say, you know, probably at least 2 years that we've had an open psychiatry position that we just haven't been able to fill.
And you think that's typical of other VA facilities as well?
Yeah, experience? Absolutely. And I know, you know, I worked in community mental health before this, and that was certainly, you know, certainly the case there as well.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break now. Coming up, we'll start taking your calls, so stay with us on The Exchange.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEP Network Organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college, NHHEAF.org. From the Melanson Company of Keene & Bowe, providing comprehensive roofing solutions since 1932, now offering solar energy, including roof-integrated systems, Melanson.com. And the Colonial Theater in Keene, presenting Ira Glass, the iconic host of PRI's This American Life, this Saturday at 8 p.m., tickets at the box office and at thecolonial.org. More in Healing the Wounds of War on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. The U.S. Supreme Court tackles states' rights and immigration. New Hampshire weather today, mostly cloudy, breezy, with a few scattered showers. Highs lower 50s in the North Country, upper 50s to lower 60s for the rest of the state. Tonight, partly cloudy for most of the state, mostly cloudy, a chance of showers in northern areas. Lows tonight from mid-30s to lower 40s across the state. This is NHPR.
Today on The Exchange, Healing the Wounds of War. We talk with experts on diagnosing and treating the mental health injuries our service members are experiencing as a result of their roles in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Join us on the phone, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests today are Lauren Hubersky, a suicide prevention coordinator for Manchester VA Medical Center and a licensed social worker. Dr. Jonathan Shea, he served as a staff psychiatrist at the Department of Veterans Affairs Boston Outpatient Clinic for 20 years. And Jason Hansman, who served in the U.S. Army in Iraq from 2004 to 2005. He is the online community manager for the organization Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. So, Dr. Shea, let's come back to, I guess, the most basic question. Is it simply a lack of resources? Is it a lack of funds? Is it an economics question as to why the VA has these shortages?
I really see this as, in many ways, a failure of imagination. I would like to underline something Lauren said, and that is that they have brought mental health together with primary care. I'd like to take that one step further and see every single primary care doctor in the country and in the armed forces feel truly empowered to do the most important single thing for a psychologically injured veteran, and that is help with sleep. Repetitive combat nightmares, which are a prodigious wrecker of sleep, there is one of the very tiny handful of real breakthrough drugs, and that's a 50-year-old drug for high blood pressure called Prazosin that nobody's making a nickel off of. It's way out of patent. It's not a brand name drug anymore. It's cheap and effective in tiny, tiny doses. And this has been shown by a double-blind placebo-controlled trials initially at the Seattle, Washington VA. And so this is not in doubt. This is not a speculative thing, a hobby horse that Shea is riding. It's actually part of the VA DOD clinical practice guidelines for PTSD. And yet very, very few clinicians even know about it. And it's one of the most valuable things to come along. It's just that nobody's making a nickel off of it.
So Jason, these are we've spent quite a bit of time talking about PTSD, but some of the other issues we're hearing about are an increased suicide rate. I just learned this morning that only about a dozen or so, maybe it's as high as 15, states actually track veteran suicide rates. So I'm not sure we even have an accurate grasp on the overall numbers. But it's also traumatic brain injuries. Are these the issues that we should be concerned about when it comes to mental health care, or are there others?
Certainly suicide, TBI, are probably the hallmarks of mental health specifically. But also you have to think of some of the root causes as well, like homelessness, unemployment. With the unemployment rate, we're tracking about 17% last year, unemployment rate amongst Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. I mean, that alone can cause mental health issues or exacerbate mental health issues. But I want to highlight what you said earlier about tracking. The issue is, as you said, that a lot of states, the entire country, does not track veteran suicides. In fact, not all the branches publicly report their suicides. In fact, only the Army reports their suicides on a monthly basis. And just last month alone, 28 soldiers committed suicide. I mean, that alone is an alarming number when it comes to mental health.
In fact, this is being described as a pandemic among that community. New Hampshire, by the way, is one of those states that does not track veteran suicide rates. So, you know, on one level, I'm not sure we have a clear sense of what the problem is. On another level, clearly there is, at least, you know, to put it mildly, an elevated rate of suicides among vets. And I guess I'm not altogether clear on how well we're doing with these folks. Lauren, this issue of increased suicide rates, this is something you all must be wrestling with.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And I think it's also, it's hard because we don't, as a state, you know, track the rates. So it makes, you know, it can make program development difficult at times to figure out, okay, which problem are we sort of going to focus on? So, you know, as a facility, we do the best we can to, you know, to track suicide attempts and completions to see sort of where, you know, the suicide prevention program wants to go. So, you know, just a couple of things that we've done in the past couple of years, you know, we tend to see a lot of suicide attempts are overdoses. So, you know, we've done a really good job as far as restricting medications with those we identify at high risk for suicide. We've also done quite a bit with gun safety, and New Hampshire as a whole has done quite a bit with gun safety and, you know, gun locks throughout the state. We also see a lot of chronic pain in the veteran population. So the VA actually about a year ago started a chronic pain class that veterans can go to. It's 4 classes, and I actually do a presentation in that class around, you know, suicide prevention awareness and different resources they can use and, you know, safety planning.
Great. Well, Jason mentioned the different factors that contribute to this. One of the other issues that comes up is the issue of multiple deployments. Jason, have you found that to be a source of concern as well?
Certainly. I think a recent study actually said that the more deployments you go on, the more likely it is that you have PTSD. And certainly I've seen it amongst our membership. Those that have multiple deployments have increased issues with mental health. And even with, those other issues like homelessness and employment and the other things that are contributing factors to mental health. So certainly multiple deployments are kind of one of those things that is, I think, an indicator that someone might have mental health issues along the line.
And we are in unprecedented territory here. This is the longest war the United States has been engaged in. I'm not sure if we've had experiences in the past where the number of deployments that combat soldiers have made are as high as they are now. So this is sort of a problem that continues to grow.
Certainly. I think, it's not only the number of deployment, but length of deployment, type of deployment. Certainly the people from World War II, they, as I believe was mentioned earlier, they went over there for 2 years at a time, came back, and they were done. That, I think, kind of helps. But having to go back and forth, I think that is this increasing stress on the family and on the individual.
Well, let's go to the phones. Trish from Londonderry. Good morning, Trish.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling in regards to the suicide rate and wondered if anyone had record numbers from in theater. My nephew-in-law, who was a career Army man, killed himself 3 years ago in Iraq, 10 days before coming home. I know that people talk about the suicide rate once they're here in the States, but how many troops are killing themselves in theater?
That's a great question. It's certainly not something that I've seen recently. Jason, is that something you've come across?
No, I know that the Army, they wrap that up. So in theater and then back at home, the Army wraps it up into one number, but I have not seen specifically in theater numbers for any of the branches.
Dr. Shea, anything about in theater suicides?
Just that the way that what gets the counter to click that this is a suicide is for the Criminal Investigation Division to sign it out as a suicide. So you know that a lot of the myriad ways that you can get yourself dead in a war zone that can be seen as accidental tend not to be counted. Going for a walk in a minefield, for example. How did that happen? Unless there's a suicide note, the CID isn't likely to sign it out as a suicide.
So at the end of the day, the Army accounting on this is one number, but if we wanted to know more, we would have to consult those investigative reports.
Yes, and also know what their criteria are for clicking the counter.
So this isn't something that's easily discerned?
Not easily. I think we can expect that it's underreported by some significant amount.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, thank you for your call, Trish. Ben in Hillsboro joins us. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Wayne. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. What's your question?
I've got more three quick comments. One is on the Marine program for officers coming forward and saying they've had trouble. I served 6 years in the 82nd Airborne, went to Afghanistan twice, ramped up for other deployments, but never went. And the career officers who have a lot of rank, career enlisted who have a lot of rank, talking about their problems, that's one thing. They're towards the end of their career. A young sergeant like myself talking about their problems, your career's still done. They might say you should talk about it, but they're not going to want to put you in a position that is critical if you've got that going on.
So, Ben, you're saying that despite the what we're hearing, that folks are encouraged to talk about, those who are active duty, who are actively serving, who are being told you should talk about these issues, you should seek out the help, the resources that are there, but that, in fact, there are potential career consequences if they do so.
Whether or not it's true that the consequences are there, we certainly felt that the consequences were there.
So that's the perception.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So that's just my observation on that. My second observation was, I forget the lady's name from Manchester.
Lauren Herbersky.
Yeah. How you doing, Lauren? And so I've been through the Manchester VA, and I've recently given up on it. They were a great help when I first got back and eventually had to be hospitalized for stuff, mental health issues. And they were awesome. And I had an awesome doctor, psychologist, who was so awesome he got himself promoted. And I was no longer able to see him. And then they gave me another awesome doctor who was so awesome she got herself promoted. And I was no longer able to see her. And then they gave me a guy in some dark, grungy corner who asked me rote questions and gave me rote answers and just sat there and stared at me. And when I asked for another appointment, they said, oh, yeah, well, we'll be able to get you one in about 6 weeks. And my last two doctors had been talking about how I need to be seen once a week, once every 2 weeks at least, because we need to work on this stuff, and it's very, it affects my life, my schoolwork, my work, my family life.
So Ben, is the point is that you had a mixed experience there, or that is there something specific that you'd like to see done differently?
I guess, and I understand if she's saying that there's a lack of doctors and a lack of nurses, then there is a lack of doctors and a lack of nurses. But I guess that's the answer, is get more doctors and more nurses. But as soon as I turned around and went and used my copay to go get a doctor out in the civilian world, I had an appointment in a week.
So Lauren, this Ben had a mixed experience.
Yeah.
What can he do if he has a negative experience? What are his options with the VA?
So, you know, and I'm sorry that you had that experience. And I think, you know, I've been there for 3 years and we've seen, you know, I've seen my share of, you know, turnover or, you know, folks moving into different positions. I was hired as a substance abuse therapist there and moved into the suicide prevention position. So, you know, unfortunately, that does happen. So, you know, folks have a couple of different avenues they can go down. You know, I don't know if you had ever spoken to our patient advocate. Her name's Marty Jones. So she's, you know, one of the people that you could certainly talk to if you had concerns regarding your care at the VA. And then we also have a mental health clinic coordinator. Her name's Dale Rozek. And she can actually, you know, help advocate for you in that realm. And I think, unfortunately, your experience is one I've heard other times too, that, you know, you get into treatment and then availability might not be, you know, 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, or, you know, sometime between 4 and 6 weeks in between appointments. And, you know, I think that, you know, more recently we started to do things like we have a lot more group offerings, because I think that peer component is huge, and I think we don't always give it enough credit. I think people sometimes view individual, you know, mental health care as individual counseling. And while individual counseling can be hugely helpful, you know, I think, you know, group therapy or peer-to-peer support can, you know, sort of helps people to turn that corner.
Yeah, I definitely want to come back to this issue of peer-to-peer. Today on The Exchange, we're talking about healing the wounds of war. We're talking about the various mental health issues that veterans are coming home with and the kind of care that they're getting or not getting. Join us in the conversation. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us at theexchange@nhpr.org. Let's spend a little bit more time talking about that peer-to-peer piece. You know, by way of my own story with this, my father's a disabled veteran, and he went for years to the VA and saw doctors and didn't have the kind of success he wanted. But when he got into his first sort of other veterans in a group together talking about their issues, it was a complete transformation for him. Mm-hmm. So talk to me a little bit, Lauren, about the peer-to-peer piece and how that works at the VA Medical Center.
So we're in sort of the baby stages of developing an actual peer-to-peer program through the Manchester VA. So right now we're in the process of hiring a part-time peer that we're going to bring on, and they're going to run some groups and do some individual work with folks. And I think, you know, it's important to recognize, you know, other agencies in the state or other organizations that are already doing this. The Vet-to-Vet program offers peer support throughout the state right now, and we refer a lot of folks over to that. You know, local VFWs and American Legion, you know, do more informal peer-to-peer work.
And you find those to be very successful?
Yes, you know, absolutely.
Dr. Shea, we've got about a minute and a half, and I'll come back to you after the break on this issue as well. But I know you've got some strong views on the peer-to-peer. Will you tell us about that?
Yes, doing work in groups with veterans is not a money-saving business. It's the superior way to do this work with veterans. It's the royal road to recovery for veterans is to do whatever you're doing in groups and to assure stability. Stability, stability, stability. The turnover of personnel is really poisonous to the building of trust and for one thing, the stability of the peers can buffer that if it has to happen.
And so having that opportunity to talk to someone else who has served, someone else who may have seen combat, that provides that buffer that you're describing.
Yes, recovery happens really only in community. And the primary community for any combat veteran is his peers. And that's why the key preventive recommendation is train people together, send them into danger together, and bring them home together and give them enough time at home to talk over with each other what they've just been through. That's the natural processes of recovery. And social refreshment.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about this and get your thoughts. Join us on the conversation. Take a quick break now. Coming up, more of your calls. So stay with us.
Today on Word of Mouth, scientists announce a blood test that could diagnose depression. Will early detection lead to better treatment or just boost profits for big pharma? And genius at infancy? A cognitive psychologist doubts the predictive power of testing babies. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth shows its gift for ideas today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Waste Management, producing enough energy to power more than 1 million homes every year. By 2020, they expect to double that output. Learn more at thinkgreen.com. And the Courier Museum of Art in Manchester, presenting a new vision, modernist photography, featuring striking images from the 1920s to the present. Details at courier.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Wayne Lesprince in for Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we focus on U.S.-Iranian relations. Email us your questions for our guests before the show at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 a.m. Today, we're looking at how well our veterans are being served when they return from war with mental health injuries. Call in and join our conversation at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Jason, I want to just follow up on the peer-to-peer piece. What's your experience been with this type of counseling or this type of treatment?
I think it's something that vets know that they want. We actually started an online community to do exactly this peer-to-peer support, community of veterans. Started about 3 years ago. It's had explosive growth, and it has literally changed lives inside of there. To have vets from across the country talk to each other about their issues, when they're not going to open up all the time, like instantly to a mental health professional, but they'll open up almost instantly to another vet. We just did a survey actually over the winter, and 90% of our veterans said that peer support groups are very important to them or somewhat important to them.
Wow, that's a staggering statistic. 90%. Is it a preference for peer-to-peer, or this is very important to them?
It is very important or somewhat important.
It's
important to them.
So, Lauren, does this explain why the VA in Manchester is going down this road?
Yeah, I think, you know, we just, you know, once we've gotten folks into groups, you know, we have a very strong substance abuse program at the Manchester VA, and a good portion of the treatment there is groups. And I think, you know, the veterans have voiced and that it's just been hugely helpful for them. And it's oftentimes what's keeping them sober. So
it does make a big difference.
Absolutely.
And Dr. Shea, this is something that you have been talking about for quite some time, but it sounds like is it fair to say there's been a lag in the VA sort of embracing this more broadly?
The VA, I have to say, having been within it and now having retired from it, I have to say candidly that the VA is terrified of truly fostering solidarity among the veterans it serves. It's like people break out in hives.
Why is that? Why is that the case?
Well, because any time you create connections and trust, cohesion, the military term, solidarity among people who didn't have it before, you are creating social power. And the thing I've tried to hammer into the minds of my VA colleagues with very limited success is that if you have the courage to work with that social power, you will perform miracles. If you fight it, they can often destroy you, and that's why many VA clinicians and certainly VA administrators are frightened of it. They don't want to create it, it's sort of like the fear that you're going to create a union in a company that previously didn't have a union. Well, you go back to Willard Waller in 1944, The Veteran Comes Back. Still the best single book on the subject, including my own books. And he made it really clear that the road to recovery is through veterans supporting each other, and that they become noisy and demanding and an enormous pain in the neck, but that is a sign of success when you have fostered an environment in which that happened.
That's fascinating. Jason, you work with the Veterans Advocacy Organization, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Have you found, or has your organization found it easy to work with the VA, or are you experiencing some of that, resistance that Dr. Shea is describing?
You know, the VA is a very big organization. I think we've had a lot of success working with parts of the VA, such as the Veteran Crisis Line and kind of the smaller local VA vet centers, the medical clinics. But it's huge. There's a lot of bureaucracy, and you know, it's still hard to work with big VA, VA down in Washington D.C. We have a hard time kind of getting through to them. We have yet to meet with the secretary of the VA, Secretary Shinseki. So we've had some troubles kind of getting to the top of the VA. And I think that's because, as Dr. Shea said, we're a vets organization and we're noisy. If the VA is not doing something that we like or not doing something that our membership likes, you know, we're gonna say something, such as this IG report, which is kind of a scathing report on what the VA is doing across the board.
I think you make a really important point. One is that there is this larger VA bureaucracy, but there's a tremendous amount of really good work being done at those individual VA centers, medical centers, in places like Manchester, Hampton, Virginia, and other places.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think one of the points, I think I mentioned this early on, is kind of the standard of care across the VA as a whole is kind of sporadic as well. There are good VAs, there are bad VAs. I mean, there are three VAs here in New York City, and each one has things that they're good at, and each one has things that they're very bad at. I think that's kind of the blessing and curse of the VA as a whole, is that they can't quite, and it's because of the size, certainly, but they can't quite get the standard of care across the board just where they need it to be.
There's no such thing, in a certain sense, as the VA. There's only your local VA,
right.
And it's only local veterans who know who is trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
So ask them.
Do you find that there, Lauren, that there's some difficulty there, that you are at a local VA and somehow you are being asked about decisions and policies at the National Veterans Administration?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, we hear these sort of the national statistics or these national articles coming down, and it doesn't always fit what's going on in Manchester. And that's not to say we don't obviously have our struggles. You know, we heard
sure.
Ben earlier talking about, you know, the wait time in between appointments. But, you know, I think we're a smaller VA, so I think change is a little bit easier. And so, you know, I know in mental health we're always sort of welcome to hear feedback because
sure.
we can sort of make those changes a little bit easier.
Sure. Today on The Exchange, we're talking about veterans coming home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the mental health issues they have and the care that they're trying to get and getting. Join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477 or 1-800-892-NHPR. And let's go to Bill in Loudoun. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is my father was a World War II veteran. And ever since I was a child, he was an alcoholic. And I can remember him waking up screaming in the middle of the night, and that he would never talk about any of his experiences. And then a little while ago, quite a while ago, I met up with a member of the group I was working with, and he was connected with the POWs, which my father's a POW. He was a Purple Heart recipient, and he had a Silver Medal, Bronze Medal, and all that stuff. But then when he started, I started talking to him about it, and I told him my father was a POW, and he says, "Oh, give me his number, let me get in touch with him." And he did. And he invited my father and mother to meetings and meeting with other, you know, his peers. And, you know, within a couple of months, he stopped drinking, he stopped smoking, and he worked for the VA hospital for over 25 years.
Wow.
And he retired as a healthy person.
Well, Bill, thank you.
The peer pressure really helped.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And again, this is about those peer-to-peer connections. There are community-based centers, these vet centers, which really are these peer-to-peer pieces. Lauren, tell us a little bit about those.
So the vet centers are part of the VA, but they're also separate from the VA. And what's really nice about the vet centers is they do really focus on sort of this peer support piece. Many of the clinicians at the vet center in Manchester are veterans themselves. And that's sort of how the VA or the vet center started, was, you know, allowing for that peer-to-peer piece. The vet center is also great because they offer a lot of social activities. They do barbecues and Christmas parties. So, you know, it's a nice place to sort of go and just be around other veterans.
Sure. And that's exactly the kind of care that Dr. Shea has described as being very effective. Dr. Shea, yes?
Yes. And I just want to mention that for a number of years, I was apparently the only VA psychiatrist who went to the Boston Vet, went to any vet center. It was the Boston Vet Center in this case, to do med groups. And it was amazing how much I loved doing it that way and how much the veterans loved doing it that way. And I've tried to teach that model to other VA psychiatrists, and they run the other direction.
Well, certainly there's work to be done there then, it seems, if you're, as you say, this is a very successful formula and the VA has been resistant to embracing it. Let's go to Josh in Berlin. Josh?
Yes, hi. How are
good
you?
Morning, Josh.
Hello to you guys. Good morning. I was a financial assistant social worker for the Department of Veterans Services, and I did home reports and whatnot, and I was also a veterans outreach aide and employment representative. And I've interviewed, and I'm not bragging at this, I interviewed hundreds of veterans from World War II through the Gulf War. Now, I'm retired now, but I've come across an organization that's doing something for free for the veterans, and it's called PatriotOutreach.org. It has a coping strategy and a simple observation exercise, and they've been giving a lot of DVDs or CDs to the military. I believe the 82nd Airborne was given about 2,000 copies. And it has the endorsement of the Chaplains Association, and I believe they had an endorsement from the chief psychiatrist from Bethesda Naval Hospital, or I believe it's in Maryland. But the thing is that the problem I find is that with a lot of these veterans coming back is, after the Vietnam War and the extensive experience, I think that's where post-traumatic stress disorder originally was ID'd. They called it another name. I think they called it combat fatigue in World War II. Well, what I'm wondering, it's somewhat deplorable, and I'm not saying the VA isn't trying to basically take on a very daunting problem, but you would think after decades of dealing with the Vietnam veterans' experience that they would have a cohesive and fairly, effective program to deal with these veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, I'm not going to go on, but I'm just going to say the ultimate goal of therapy is to reduce the dependence on the therapist and ultimately give back the patient his life and self-awareness. And these men need something that's going to be confidential and powerful, taken in conjunction with peer support, medical support, and whatnot. And I'm just saying, this PatriotOutreach.org has been a very valuable tool for myself and for others. And they've gotten some very good reports, and I think it should be checked out, and it's for free. You can try the exercise. And all it does is break that chain of reliving that event time after time after time. It gives them something to anchor them so that they can wake up from that state moment to moment.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Josh. It seems that we have a theme here, that there are these other organizations or these other avenues for veterans to get some assistance. I wonder, is there a way, is this all sort of collected in one central place that veterans can go and say these are the different options you have or places you can go for services?
You know, unfortunately, I don't think there is. And that's also a struggle, I think, clinicians have or social workers have within the VA. I think there's, we sort of find these resources as we go, or a veteran will come in and say, geez, I just found this, great organization that does such and such, so I'll make a note of it. But I don't think there is, unfortunately, one place, a website where, a veteran can go and sort of get all this information. But, VA.gov certainly has quite a bit of stuff on it, so I think that's worth checking out. And I think it's also, important to mention that, I think that is absolutely correct what the caller said about, the point of therapy is to, eventually get out of therapy. And the VA is doing, Manchester does quite a bit of evidence-based practices that are, they're designed to be shorter-term intensive therapy. So it's usually, they'll come in, a veteran will come in once a week for between 8 and 20 sessions. And that's pretty appealing to a lot of veterans because they don't have to be married to therapy for the rest of their lives or mental health treatment for the rest of their lives. They'll get sort of a chunk of treatment that's focused around getting them, active and functioning again, and then they'll be able to sort of move on.
Sure. Well, last question as time runs down on us. We've gotten this IG report. We've got what some are describing as a pandemic of suicides. Is this going to be a tough question, I suppose? But are we optimistic that the VA and other organizations will be able to meet the challenges that they're facing, Lauren?
I think so. I think I'm feeling pretty confident. We heard just recently that we're going to be getting another 1,900, folks nationally for the mental health program. So I think that's definitely a good sign. And I think if you look at things historically, the VA's taken, you know, once they identify a problem, they take a pretty aggressive stance. So, and, you know, if you look at, you know, the Veterans Crisis Line, which I just want to quickly give out the phone number, it's 800-273-TALK or 800-273-8255. We've seen the use of the crisis line increase quite a bit over the past years, and we've taken over 400,000 calls.
Dr. Shea, very quickly, reasons for optimism?
The current generation knows how to maintain its contact with each other, and the electronic media give me the most reason for optimism.
And Jason, just in a very few seconds, reason to be optimistic?
I think, you know, we've come a long ways in the past 10 years. We're learning a lot. And, you know, with vets banding together with IAVA and other organizations, I think there's lots of reason to be optimistic.
Well, thank you all for joining us. This is obviously something that we'll be talking quite a bit more about in the future and something we should all be paying attention to. Lauren Herbersky, Suicide Prevention Coordinator for the Manchester VA Medical Center and a licensed social worker. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Jonathan Shea, former staff psychiatrist at the Department of Veterans Affairs Boston Outpatient Clinic, author of Odysseus in America, Combat Trauma and Trials of Homecoming. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Shea.
My pleasure.
And Jason Hansman served in the U.S. Army in Iraq from 2004 to 2005. Thank you for your service, Jason. You are now the online community manager for the organization Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
This is Wayne Lesperance on The Exchange.